This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is Booker T. Jones. In the 1960s and 70s, he led the band Booker T. and the MGs, which had several hits, including the popular instrumental known as Green Onions. He and his MGs also were the house band for the Memphis-based soul label Stax Records, and they eventually received a Grammy Award for Lifetime Achievement. But at age 74, Booker T. Jones isn't through achieving yet. He's still performing and recording, and he's just come out with another release. But this time, it's not a single or an album. It's a book. A memoir named after one of his memorable recordings called Time is Tight. It talks of his less-than-privileged childhood in Memphis, his passion for music and songwriting, and his career backing up such legendary artists as Sam and Dave, Albert King, and Otis Redding. Terry Gross spoke with Booker T. Jones in 2007, the year he was awarded his Lifetime Achievement Grammy. Let's start with Green Onions.
Booker T., welcome to Fresh Air. It's an honor to have you on our show.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
Would you tell us the story behind the track that we just heard?
Well, that happened something of an accident. We were at the studio as session musicians to play a session for an artist who didn't show up. So we used the time to record our blues, which we called Behave Yourself, and I played it on Hammond M3 organ. And Jim Stewart, the owner, was the engineer, and he really liked it, thought it was great, actually, and wanted to put it out as a record. And so we all agreed on that, and Jim told us that we needed something to record for a B-side, because we couldn't have a one-sided record. And one of the tunes that I'd been playing on piano, we tried on Hammond organ, so that, you know, the record would have organ on both sides. And that turned out to be Green Onions.
Now, you know, Booker T. and the MGs basically became the house band for Stax Records, and you played on a lot of their recordings. How did you become a member of the Stax house band?
Well, I was in 11th grade, and my friend David Porter knew that Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla were recording one day, and I guess they had requested a baritone sax part on a song, and David thought of me. David drove over to the high school, came up with some type of hall pass and got me out of class and somehow came up with the band director's car keys and keys to the instrument room. So down we went to get the baritone sax out of the instrument room and into the borrowed car and over to Stax Records and through the door, and there I was.
Why don't we hear the recording that you played baritone sax on, which is your first recording for Stax. You want to introduce it for us?
It's called "Cause I Love You" by Rufus and Carla Thomas.
Okay, let's hear it.
Where you light up
That's Rufus and Carla Thomas, the first recording that featured Booker T, but he wasn't on keyboards. He was on baritone saxophone, and Booker T is my guest. So you stayed, obviously. I mean, you were in 11th grade. You made this recording, and you ended up becoming part of the house band. How did they... Mm-hmm. Was it hard to convince you to stay? Did you have to convince them that they needed you?
Oh, I convinced them. I actually had a paper route. That was my job in the afternoon. And I convinced them to try me out on piano and eventually organ. And I eventually played on an organ on a William Bell song, which they liked that part, You Don't Miss Your Water, on one of the sessions. So after I played that part, I had the job.
So what was it like going to high school and making records at the same time?
Oh, it was unreal. I was I was in a rush to get out of school and get my papers thrown and get over to Stax. That was my thrill every day, to get to go there and play music until, 10 or 11 o'clock every night.
Booker T and the MGs is so associated with the Stax sound, such an essential part of what is described as the Stax sound. But how would you describe the Stax sound?
I would say it's a simple, earthy sound, just born out of our blues and country and jazz roots, and also gospel. It was a sound that, we consciously tried to keep simple and with a lot of feeling.
Do you remember the first time you met Otis Redding?
Otis was a valet for a band from Georgia. He was carrying the clothes and doing the driving and going for the food and coffee and shining shoes or whatever he had to do to keep the band going. And I remember the day he pulled up with Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers was the name of the group he was working for. They just basically came in and he sat around and waited, and they did their demo for Stax. And after they did their demo, Otis asked if he could sing a song, which was a little inappropriate, but we allowed him, Jim and Steve Cropper and the rest of us allowed him to sing a song with us, and that song was These Arms of Mine, and so everyone was moved by that. So at that moment he became Otis Redding.
So let's hear one of the records you made with Otis Redding. How about Dock of the Bay? Do you have memories of making this record?
Yes, I do have memories of that. That was a particularly special and hectic time. Otis was getting ready to go out on tour without us, and we had just returned to Memphis from the Monterey Pop Festival in Europe. Otis was disjointed and hurried and anxious and out of sorts, so he wanted to record all the time. He was insisting that we stay, uncommon hours, and we were working late at night and people were probably sleeping at the studio, and it seemed like we were working around the clock.
Well, that's not how it sounds on the record. It's not a record that sounds like it was made by people who were tired and overworked. Did the mood change once you started recording?
I'm not sure that we were tired and overworked when we did this particular one, but the week was one that we recorded, I think, a whole album in just a few days. The music always created its own energy once we started playing, so even if you were tired, playing with Otis and playing with each other, the music just... it just got a life of its own, and so the tiredness didn't matter.
Well, let's hear Dock of the Bay, Otis Redding, and my guest Booker T on keyboards on this recording.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening sun, watching the ships roll in, then I'll watch them roll away. Watching the tide roll away, just sitting on the dock of the bay, waves of tide. I left my home in Georgia, headed
so I'm just gonna sit on a dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on a dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here resting my bones.
It's Otis Redding, and my guest Booker T. Played piano and organ on many of the recordings on Stax Records, like the one we just heard. Were you close with Otis Redding?
Yes, unfortunately, yes.
Unfortunately, because he died in a plane crash.
Yes, he was a very close friend of mine. Yes.
You wrote a song called "Born Under a Bad Sign."
Mm-hmm.
That I always thought was a much older song. I mean, it's such a kind of classic blues song. I figured it was around a whole lot longer. You want to tell us the story behind writing the song?
Yes. The company had acquired Albert King as an artist, and I was assigned to be his producer. And so we needed music for him. At that time, my partner was William Bell, my writing partner. William wrote the words, and I wrote the music. In my den that night, that was one of my greatest moments in the studio, as far as being thrilled with a piece of music. I was very, very happy with the way that turned out.
What made you so happy about it? What do you particularly like about it?
The feeling of it, you know, it's the real blues, you know, done by the real people. It was Albert King from East St. Louis, you know, the left-handed guitar player. Who was just so one of a kind, and so electric, and so intense, and so serious about his music, and involved with his with the lyrics and with the song. You know, he just lost himself in the music, and he was such a one of a kind character. And we had written a song for him, and we were doing it, and it was coming off, and I was there personally in the middle of it, so it was just exhilarating. You know, it's kind of hard to describe.
Well, why don't we hear it? This is Albert King, recorded in 1967, and my guest is Booker T, who's featured on this track. Albert King from 1967. The song was co-written by my guest, pianist and organ player Booker T, who co-wrote that song. Now, when you were playing at Stax Records, when you were in Booker T and the MGs, and you were the house band and making your own records, the South was still pretty segregated, but your band was comprised of African-American and white musicians. Did racial tensions from the outside world ever affect the band, or did you feel pretty well protected by that, from that?
Well, we were insulated, you know, as most Southern social institutions are. We were insulated because we had our little door there that we locked behind us at Stax, and nobody knew what was going on in there or who we were. So we weren't affected until we became pretty famous. Around 67 or 68, after Dr. King came to the city, and Dr. King was murdered in a place that was very close to us. He was murdered at the Lorraine Hotel, and that was our meeting place, and that was a place where we ate very often. So that affected us. But in general, we didn't have big racial issues there.
When you say the assassination affected you, did it? I mean, I imagine everybody in the band was pretty upset about it. Did it?
Mm-hmm.
Did it cause any?
What I mean
tensions
is, what I mean
the
is, it brought outside attention to us and what we were doing there.
Right.
The fact that we were interracial, I like to call it a not too well kept secret that we were interracial. I think, you know, when we were playing music, that nobody really cared that we were interracial. I think they cared more about the music. I think whites and blacks both didn't pay too much attention to the racial aspect of it.
Did you feel there were times you needed to keep it kind of a secret?
Absolutely. The logistics of it demanded it. You know, we couldn't travel when we started without having two of us go get food, and sometimes those two were myself and Al, sometimes those two were Steve and Doug. The other two would have to check into hotels. And,
right, because two of you were white, two of you were black.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So we always had to have, we were always in somebody else's territory, no matter where we were.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve and Doug and all of the white members of Stax began to love soul food, and I think they preferred to hang out at our restaurants. So we just really didn't have a problem as long as the rest of the world didn't have a problem with us.
You left Stax Records in 1969,
mm-hmm.
Which I think was the same year Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Mm-hmm.
Did that have any reason? Was that part of the reason why you left?
I left after Stax was sold to Gulf and Western.
Because it was sold, or?
Well, not because it was sold, but because it changed. Because the owners had control, and the owners were able to dictate how this company was run. And so they did that. They had every right to do that. They had big companies, and they knew what they were doing. They had Paramount Pictures, and they were a very successful company, and they decided that they wanted to change things in Memphis, and so they did. And the things they changed made it lose its appeal for me.
What were the changes?
They changed the outlook. They made us feel as though, well, they made us meet a quota as far as how much music we produced. That was the first thing that really affected me, because we were always able to have our down, you know, dry periods when we just couldn't come up with anything and when it just wasn't happening, and so everybody would get tense and, you know, we would argue, and we just absolutely had no music. But then, to come out of that, we would come up with something great. But Gulf and Western sent memos that caused us to change our production techniques to the fact that we had three bands going around the clock, and they wanted a certain number of albums in a certain time period. And so the president and the vice president, the people who were running the company, had to bring other producers in from other cities. They brought in producers from Los Angeles and Detroit, you know, because they had to meet these quotas, and it became a different company.
So when you left, did you leave on your own?
Yes, I did. I left all by myself. Nobody came with me.
What was your life like when you moved to Los Angeles?
Well, I my life was uncertain for a while, but then I found friends in California that rescued me, and so I was able to survive out here.
And how did your musical life change?
Well, as I said, I found friends who were also somewhat nonconformists who rescued me. I met Clarence Avant, who at the time was one of the leading entrepreneurs, African-American entrepreneurs in the music industry, and he had a startup label that he was working with in California, and he had this guy that was building airplane toilets in Inglewood who had songs that he really loved. His name was Bill Withers. And
Bill Withers was building airplane toilets?
absolutely. And Clarence called up and sent Bill out to my ranch in Malibu, and Bill came up with, they came out there with a little tablet full of papers and an old beat-up guitar and started to sing songs, and he had some great songs in there, so I was able to work with him. And then
So you actually helped discover him.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
And I had friends that introduced me to Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. And they were starting a record label. And
that was A&M Records.
Uh-huh, yeah. So we had a relationship. So I worked with them for a few years and ended up producing and arranging albums on Rita Coolidge and various people on their label. And I actually ended up doing solo albums on A&M Records during that time. And I was able to survive.
And you produced Willie Nelson's, you know, now classic Stardust album.
Yes, uh-huh, mm-hmm. Yes, that was one of the reasons why I think I made the right decision was because I was able to work in some different genres that I wouldn't have been able to do at Stax Records.
Mm-hmm.
Stax wanted to keep it pretty much Memphis soul, which was fine, but Stax was not ever going to be, I don't think, a pop label or a country label, so I don't think I would have been able to take Willie Nelson there or Earl Klug. I don't think we would have been able to do jazz there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And your tastes are so wide-ranging. You wanted to work in a wide-ranging way.
Yes, it's one of my greatest disadvantages, liking so many different kinds of music.
Can I ask you about your name?
I'm named after my father, was Booker T. Jones Sr., and he was named after Booker T. Washington, and the name is Booker Taliaferro.
And how did you end up, like, dropping the Jones from the professional part of your name? Because it was, like, Booker T. and the MGs.
Well, yeah, the band needed a name when we recorded Green Onions. Al Jackson, the drummer, you know, was, you know, what do we call it? And he said, well, Booker T. and the, and they just came up with MGs.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little, this guy, this engineer on the song, Chips Moman, was driving a little British Leyland sports car. It's called an MG. I don't know if you've ever seen those.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it parked outside. He used to do tricks with it and everything in the snow, you know. And so they looked out the window, Booker T and the MGs.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You know, thank you for having me, Terry.
Booker T. Jones speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. He's just published a memoir called Time is Tight. On Monday's show...
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
Our guest will be Dan Pippenbring, whom the singer Prince had selected to help him write his autobiography. But shortly after they began working together, Prince died. Pippenbring's new book, The Beautiful Ones, includes the pages Prince had written about his childhood, adolescence, and sexual awakening, as well as Pippenbring's personal essay about working with Prince, and a collection of Prince's letters, photos, and lyric sheets. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our producer today was Sam Brigger. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.